Okay, we are ready to continue our discussion of financial ratio analysis by looking at the various ratios that we haven't covered yet. So, again, I think I mentioned it at the end of our previous... I know I did, because I just did it. We want to take a look at balance sheet and the income statement. So it's a good idea to have those printed out. You can have them up on the screen and bounce back and forth. It's up to you. Plus, having the formula sheet printed would also be handy. We do that in the... face-to-face class, but again, it's up to you. It's up to you whether you want to do that or not. I got my cheat sheet ready because I've done the calculations to make sure I don't mess up while I'm doing the presentation here. So I've already done it, but you want to check, make sure I didn't mess up because I make mistakes like everybody else. So the first group we'll take a look at are the profitability ratios. These are financial ratios that measure a firm's returns by relating profits to sales, profits to assets, profits to equity, and there are a few others. They're variations on a theme when they may come across them. One of them is a very famous one that Warren Buffett uses, and it's basically the same idea. We're going to take a look at their profitability. So, net profit margin, gross margin, operating margin, return on assets, and return on equity. We'll take a look at each one in detail, and we'll do a few calculations. Profitability ratios allow us to measure the ability of a firm to earn an adequate return on sales, an adequate return on total assets, and an adequate return on the invested capital. So let's take a look now at slide 21, and the net profit margin, also called the after-tax profit margin. I have heard it a few times called the after-tax profit margin, but most people are going to call it the net profit margin. And so what do we get from this? Huh? How do we get this? It's the rate of profit being earned from earnings after your expenses and taxes. So what are we looking at? We're looking at the bottom line. That's the net income, right? So if you go to Ford's income statement, what's the bottom line, the net profit, the net income? Then what we're going to do is we're going to relate that to the top line number, the total revenue. So did you find those two numbers? The net income at the bottom of the income statement is $3.682 million. They took in $160 billion of revenue. So if you do that calculation, you get 2.3%. And for some reason, Yahoo says it's 2.29%. I don't know why. But basically 2.3%. Now, that doesn't sound like much, does it? Everything Ford does and they make 2.3% on their total revenue, well, we have to go look at other car companies, right? We have to look at what GM and Toyota and BMW and the other car companies do. But guess what? You're going to find that that's typical. Car companies, they're immense operations. And they have tremendous revenues. And it looks like they don't make a whole lot of money, but they actually make billions of dollars when times are good. And when times are not so good, they lose billions of dollars. But so we cannot just look at this number in a vacuum. We have to compare it to companies in the industry, right? And, of course, the higher, the better. But in this case, it's kind of low. But let's now take a look at their gross margin, right? What is the gross margin? Well, we take the gross profit, not the net income, but the gross profit, and divide that by the total revenue. And our gross profit, can you find that on the income statement? I see $22,706,000, 22.706. And divide that by the top line number. So 22.706. It's up to you if you want to. I use point. You can do 22,706 divided by 160,340, the total revenue, or 160.34. And you get 14%. Now that's looking a whole lot better, isn't it? Right, exactly. because that's our gross profit. And of course, a company wants to reduce their net income as much as they can, on paper at least, because then they're going to pay fewer dollars in taxes. And of course, if we took a look at other companies in the industry, we'd probably see various examples of that are pretty darn close. And then the operating margin is the operating income divided by the total revenue. And in this case, our operating income is only $3,184,000,000, less than the net income. So my goodness, the operating margin is actually less than the growth, than the net profit margin. Why? Because of Ford earning money from other activities. And yep, you guessed it, the higher the better, varies greatly from industry to industry. So when we're looking at a specific company, we always need to look at its competitors within the industry. When we find a company that's atypical of its competitors in an industry, it is a signal that we have more investigative work to do. So have you been doing the calculations? I mean, you only got to do a few, because once you do a few, you go, okay, I can do these, it's not that big deal. And in the assignment, I show you the whole, we show you the whole list of them, and I ask you to do 12. And please do two, at least two from each category, so you just don't do all the ones you can look up. Do at least two from each category, okay? So you don't have to do all of them, but some people do. Some students will fill in the whole thing, and it doesn't take long, so it's up to you if you want to do the whole thing or not. So those were the we're not done yet with profitability. We still have to do a return on assets and return on equity. These two are very popular, right? These are measurements of how profitable a company is relative to its total assets. So we take the bottom line on the income statement, and then we divide it by how much assets the company owns. Net income, that's on the, we've looked at that several times so far, that's on the income statement, $3.682 billion, and then you divide by the total assets. Now, where are the total assets? Right, they're on the balance sheet. So we go to the total assets, we see that Ford has $256.5 billion in assets. So boy, this number looks really small. 1.44, for some reason Yahoo shows 1.07. I'm not sure why the disparity, but still a tiny little number. Well, because of all the assets that we need in a car company to produce that income. So let's read at the bottom. Return on assets looks at the amount of resources a company needs to support their operations. It reveals how effective the company is in generating profits from the assets it has available. The higher the better, and it's a very popular ratio, but in the car industries, right, they need tremendous resources to build those cars. So 1.44, oh well, I mean, that's, you look at GM and the other companies, and you think, well, that's basically what's going on in the car companies. But then, of course, in a company like a software company, right, well, they need computers and people to write the programs, it's going to be a whole lot different. So we have to compare that to other software companies. Slide number 25, return on equity. It's very sometimes called return on investment. Some people use return on invested capital. That's that one I was telling you about, the little bit of a wrinkle, but the same idea. It's a measure of the overall profitability of a company in relation to how much the shareholders own of the company, the shareholders' equity. So we take that same bottom line number on the income statement, but instead of dividing it by the assets, we divide it by the equity. So now, because a return on equity uses the stockholders' equity instead of total assets for the denominator, return on equity is very sensitive to the amount of debt a company is carrying. So if a company carries a great amount of debt, the return on equity will be much higher. And you hear people say, you are using other people's money to make your money. Right, you're using the money you borrowed to make money. Some investors think this is good, right? And sure, yeah, you'd love to be able to use other people's money to make your money, but you still got to pay the darn stuff back, right? It's not your money. So others are more worried about the possible negative consequences of having too much debt, because debt can make you wind up in bankruptcy court. But if we use the stockholders' equity, can you find that number? That's at the bottom of the balance sheet, 36070. You divide the net income by the stockholders' equity, and it turns out that Ford is making a 10% return on equity. 10.21 is what I get. Yahoo reports 10.3, but it's in the ballpark. And not bad, not bad. Would you be happy with 10% of your money? I would. And so on the money that Ford has in their skin in the game, right, the money they have put up, they're making 10%. But that means they still got to pay back all that debt, right? So be careful. Yeah, so it's a dual-edged sword. Okay, so those are the profitability ratios. Now, the liquidity ratios are there to show the firm's ability to meet its day-to-day operating expenses and satisfy its short-term obligations as they come due. In other words, can we make payroll? Can we pay the rent, pay the mortgage? And so these liquidity ratios are more interested in, can you stay afloat? Can you stay liquid? Not how much beer you have for the weekend. Haha, it's a joke I use often. But no, it has something to do with how well the company is prepared to just make their day-to-day operations. And we made a quick reference in our previous presentation to the current ratio. We didn't call it the current ratio, but we look at the current assets to current liabilities. And then the net working capital is the one outlier, the one little exception. It's really not a ratio. It's the current ratio in dollar form. So we take the current assets and subtract the current liabilities. So there's the one little quirky guy. And then the acid test ratio. What a great name, right? Sometimes called the quick ratio. It's basically another version of the current ratios. So now you're going to look at the balance sheet for these guys. Okay, so let's take a look at the very popular current ratio. The current ratio is very simple to calculate. You take all of these are pretty simple to calculate. You take the current assets and divide them by the current liabilities, right? And so this is a good indicator of how stable a company is. Anything over one is considered acceptable. If your current assets equal or exceed your current liabilities, you should be able to satisfy your short-term obligations without any problem. And obviously, the greater the number is, the better, because it means you're in a better financial shape. So if you look on the balance sheet, you should find the current assets, $114,650, current liabilities, $95,570, and that gives us a current ratio of about 1.2. Right? Make sure you do that, right? It's not that hard. Which means, Ford, no problem. They can make their debts. Debts coming due, they can pay them. They're not going to go bankrupt. Piece of cake? Now, it gets ridiculous in some situations. Like, I made mention of Microsoft in 2003 when they had money coming out of their ears and they weren't paying any dividends. And their current ratio, I think, was 120-something. In other words, they're a software company. They don't have to buy a plant for $3 billion, right? They just have to buy computers and get people to program them. So then, we'll pay dividends, and then Apple's doing the same, and now Google's paying dividends because they got money coming out of their ears. But what happens if we take a look at the net working capital? Now, wait a minute. This is not a ratio. So there's the one, as we said, the one outlier. Well, this is the current ratio in dollar terms. So you take the current assets and subtract the current liabilities. So, of course, if the current assets are greater than the current liabilities, it's going to be positive, and if the other way around, it's going to be negative. So, obviously, it's telling you how much cash above and beyond their liabilities or current assets they have above and beyond their liabilities. And, you don't really hear too many people talking about this unless the company needs a significant amount of cash to do something in the near-term future. You hear about this, what you're talking about, a company like Tesla, which is trying to become a global, and they're doing, it looks like they're doing it, folks, but still, it's very, very iffy, a global manufacturer of cars in a few years, not several decades, and nobody's been able to do it in the last 80 years. There's been no new car companies in the last 80 years, folks. I mean, I figure that, look at that one, since before World War II, right? Every company has tried to make it has failed because it's just such a huge capital investment. And so they look at when they look at companies like that, they say, okay, well, how much cash do they have on hand to be able to pull this off? And it looks like, you know, so far so good. We'll see. I'm rooting for them. I don't want to use. I think I'm still toying with the idea of buying some Tesla stock just for the hell of it. That's not a good reason to buy a stock, is it? No, it's not, dear students. Please don't do that. Don't do this at home, dear students. And I probably won't do it because I'm a chicken. But also, I don't like the, I think I told you Mr. Warren Buffett's two rules. The first rule is never lose money, and rule number two is never forget rule number one. Slide number two, you're going to lose money, folks. You're going to, but over the long term, we're talking about long term. Now, slide 29. Here is the acid test ratio, the quick ratio. Well, what is this? Really, it's the current ratio without the inventory. So there's a couple different ways to calculate that. And what you often see is cash plus accounts receivable plus short-term investments plus other current investments. But that's too hard. The easy way is to just take the current assets and subtract the inventory. And then you divide it by the current liability. So it's the same as the current ratio, except we exclude inventory. Well, why? Well, think about it. This ratio measures the ability of the company to meet its short-term obligations, even if its current inventory becomes obsolete or undesirable, and hence difficult or impossible to be turned into cash. So in some instances, like computers, or as Lucent Technology found out, cell phone equipment, that inventory becomes undesirable, becomes obsolete immediately, almost immediately. Whereas cars, it's a couple years old. People still buy it. If it's an old year old model, they'll still buy it. You have to reduce the price a little bit, but not a whole lot. And so you have to look at the industry. This is why, by the way, dear students, in the 1980s, and then certainly in the 1990s, Dell was one of the pioneers, but all the computer companies do this now. And all the other companies have followed suit. They call it just-in-time inventory. In other words, Dell didn't build any computer. They developed, they designed and created these computers, but they would not develop, they would not build the computer until somebody put in an order for the computer. So they didn't have any computers sitting around the warehouse. Only if you ordered it, that's when they built it. And so they pioneered this just-in-time inventory. And other companies, of course, around the world have followed suit because it's a much more efficient way of doing business. Plus, you don't wind up with inventory that's obsolete. But it has a downside. Exactly. If there's any kind of supply disruption, oh, boy. And a few years ago, there was a supply disruption in terms of hard drives because they're all built in the same area. And there was a flood. They're all built in Indonesia, right? There was a big flood, so all the companies were scrambling to get hard drives. So it has its downside. But certainly companies have found the just-in-time inventory to be a very efficient way of building. So those were the liquidity. Now let's take a look at the activity ratios. And these are useful for looking at the efficiency of a company. Sometimes they're called the efficiency ratios. They are used to measure how well a firm is managing its assets. The activity ratios measure a firm's ability to convert different accounts within their balance sheet into cash or sales. And companies will try to turn their production into cash or sales as fast as possible because this will generally lead to higher revenues. Now, remember, every industry is different, but we take a look at the competitors and we see very similar amounts. If we see something that's not similar, right, that's a red flag. Maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, but it just means we need more investigation to do. So accounts receivable turnover, inventory turnover, total assets turnover, and we use the balance sheet and the income statement. So let's go take a look at slide 31. The accounts receivable turnover is a measure of how accounts receivable are managed. And we take a look at the total revenue and divide that by the accounts receivable. Oh, by the way, I forgot to give you the numbers for Ford's net working capital and asset test ratio. So maybe you stopped the presentation and did the calculations, but let me give you those numbers. The net working capital is $19.08 billion. And the asset test ratio was over 1.08, which means Ford's got plenty of resources, even if their inventory becomes obsolete, which it won't because people still buy their vehicles. Okay, now, my apologies for that. Let's take a look at the accounts receivable turnover. Total revenue from the income statement divided by the accounts receivable from the balance sheet. The higher the number, the better, of course. It indicates the return a company is getting from its investment in accounts receivable. Well, what are accounts receivable? You accounting students know this upside down, right? But that's money that is owed to us. And when you deal with business to business, this is very typical. You know, businesses, you sell them your business, you sell to another business, you give them you basically give them the stuff, and you then have them pay you over, the next 30 days, 60 days. It's called net 30, net 60. Well, by maintaining accounts receivable, firms are indirectly extending interest-free loans to their clients. A high ratio implies that the company either operates on a cash basis, there are no accounts receivable because people pay you right away, or its extension of credit and collection of accounts receivable is efficient. A low ratio implies that the company should reassess its credit policies in order to ensure the timely collection of imparted credit, not earning interest for the firm. In other words, they're paying you slowly, and that's not something you'd really like to happen, but that's the way some industries work. For example, the Defense Department. Dear students, Uncle Sam pays his debts, he always has, but he takes his good old sweet time doing it. And some of the defense contractors have just become used to this, that's the way we do business. Well, this is ancient history, but in the 1970s and 80s, the Defense Department made a big push to get smaller firms to apply for their contracts. And so the smaller firms did, and they got some contracts. And then the Defense Department, in their historical, lackadaisical manner, didn't pay them after 6 months or 9 months. And these companies are going, wait a minute, you can't do this to us. We don't have the resources to wait for a year to get paid. And so now it's my understanding. I worked a few summers for a few months each. In the Defense Department, then I worked for a Defense Department contractor. A million years ago, folks, a long time ago. And my understanding is that it's much better now. I've asked people in the military, is it much better? It's, we pay a lot faster now. I said, good. Okay, so let's take, if we take the total revenue, which is a very large number, $160 billion, $340 million, and we divide that by the accounts receivable, 65. It turns out that Ford is turning over their accounts receivable a little over 2.5 times, a little less than 2.5 times a year. That's kind of inefficient, but hey, they're pulling in tens of billions of dollars, so don't complain too much, right? But now let's take a look at the inventory turnover, because this one is a little bit more important in that inventory, as we said, can become obsolete, and we don't like that. So we take the total revenue and we divide it by the inventory. So our total revenue, again, is $160,340. Our inventory on the balance sheet is $11,220. Is that what you get, right? And so what do we get for Ford? $14,000. What does that mean? That means a little less than once a month they are turning over their inventory. So in other words, they don't keep anything for more than 3 or 4 weeks, which is, you know, pretty darn good in the car company. If you look at a grocery store, now you walk into a grocery store or a drugstore and you see everything on the shelves and you think, well, that's the way it always is. Wrong. Wrong. Right. That stuff that you're buying is, it was put on the shelf yesterday. And so they turn over their inventory, you know, every week or every couple of weeks. So every industry is different, right? The higher the number, the better. The less time an item spends in inventory, and the better the return, the company is able to earn from its funds tied up in inventory. I should change that, right? The higher the number, the less time an inventory spends in inventory. I'm sorry, less time an item spends in inventory, and the better the return the company is able to earn from funds tied up in inventory. My apologies. Yeah, that makes sense. As with all ratios, we must compare it to other industry averages. A low turnover implies poor sales and therefore excess inventory. A high ratio implies either strong sales or they might not be doing good inventory buying or maintenance. Or it just means, that they turn things over very, very quickly like they do in the grocery stores. High inventory levels are unhealthy. We don't really like them because they represent an investment with a rate of return of zero. And as we said, it also opens up the company up to trouble in case of falling prices or obsolete products. And this is the dilemma of car dealerships. You know, car dealerships, you love to have lots of different cars on the lot because it gives people more choice to walk around. But at the same time, those cars ain't earning you any money until you sell them. So you'd really like to have only two cars on the lot, or three cars. And this is why dealerships hate Tesla, right? They absolutely hate Tesla. Why? Because Tesla has, you know, two or three cars in their store, and you, because they only have two or three, well, maybe they have a few more, but they don't have that many cars, and so they don't have any inventory sitting in the store. And then you go there and you say, oh, I'd like this car. I like this, the Model 3 or the Model S or whatever, and I want it in this color and I want these options, and then they send it to you, right? So that's why car dealerships absolutely hate Tesla, because they have an unfair advantage. They're not tying up all that money in inventory. That's not making them any money. Slide 33. The total asset turnover. Well, this is a measure of how the total assets are managed with regard to the revenue. So we take that total revenue again, the $160,340, but this time we divide it by the total assets $256, and we get it about 0.6, about every 6 months or so, less than 6 months. But the total asset turnover measures the firm's efficiency at using assets to support sales and revenue. The higher the number, the better. Companies with low profit margins tend to have high asset turnover. That's the grocery stores. And those with high profit margins have low asset turnover, cars or nuclear aircraft carriers, right? Exactly. Cool. So those are the activity ratios. And our last group are the leverage ratios. That's sometimes called solvency ratios. And these were very important to Mr. Benjamin Graham. Oh boy, did he love these. And so you'll see when you eventually read the Intelligent Investor how masterfully he used these ratios. These are financial ratios that are used to measure the amount of debt being used to support operations and the ability of the firm to service that debt. So the first one is the debt-to-equity ratio, debt-equity ratio, which should look familiar because we basically did this in Business 121 Financial Planning and Money Management for those of you who have done it. The big difference is the number of zeros after the number, the size of the numbers. And then the times interest earned. Mr. Graham was very keen on this one. Total debt to total assets. We use the balance sheet and the income statement. Why do we use the term leverage? Well, we're going to use this leverage term going into the rest of the semester at various times. Debt is often referred to as leverage, right? The idea is that you are using other people's money to make your money. You are using the borrowed money as a lever to increase your earnings. Think about it, folks. Because we're going to use it, we're going to use this term into the future. When one firm buys another firm using borrowed money, it is often referred to as a leveraged buyout, in which case now the company has a lot of debt that they have to deal with. Some people, again, are excited about this because it means you're using other people to make money to make your money, and you can make a lot more. But other people are worried, as well they should be, with the fact that now you've got a lot more debt you got to service, and if you can't service the debt, oh boy, bad things will happen, and can happen and do. So let's go to slide 35 and look at the debt-to-equity ratio. It's a measure of the company's financial leverage calculated by dividing their long-term debt by the shareholders' equity. It indicates what proportion of debt, equity and debt the company is using to finance its activity. So we take the long-term debt, which in Ford's case is a pretty large number, $100 billion, $107.20, and we divide it by the total stockholders' equity of about $36 billion, and you find that their debt-to-equity ratio is 279%, almost three times as much debt as equity. Now, if you were in this situation, you or I were in this situation, we'd be hating life because this is not a great position to be in. But in the case of car companies, go check out the others because you'll find that they're, not all of them, but they're in this same situation where they owe tremendous amounts of money. Why? Because they need it. They need that capital to build those cars. A higher debt-to-equity ratio generally means that the company has been aggressive in financing its growth with debt. This can result in lower earnings as a result of the additional interest expense, right? Well, we pay fewer dollars in taxes. Sometimes investors only use interest-bearing long-term debt instead of total liabilities. They, kick out the current liabilities. But I think the lower the better, in my humble opinion, but I'm not running a car company, so that's, so shut up, Payano. Slide 36, the times interest earned. This is the one I told you about that was Mr. Graham was very interested in. This measures the ability of a company to meet its fixed interest payments. In other words, can you meet those debt payments? You take a look at the earnings before interest and taxes, and this is on the income statement. Take a look at the income statement, and you divide it by the interest expense. In other words, how much interest do we have to pay? How much did we earn before we paid the interest and taxes, and how much interest do we have to pay? And if you take a look at Ford's for 2018, the earnings before interest and taxes is $5.59 billion, and the interest expense was over $1 billion, $1.240 billion. It turns out that they are earning their interest about four times over. So relax, Ford can pay its interest. They're not going to get hauled off the bankruptcy court for not paying the interest on their debts. We use the time interest earned to determine how frequently interest payments are earned by the company during a year. The higher the better, and normally 3 or 4 is considered adequate. So in this case, 4.5 is what we get, 4.51. So that means about every 3 months, actually less than 3 months, every 2.7 months or whatever, Ford earns enough money to pay its interest expense, which is, you know, pretty darn good. Pretty darn good. And then you look at companies like software companies, it's like 60 or something. Because they don't have too much debt and they make a lot of money. And so look at each individual company in comparison to the companies in that industry. And then, last but not least, no, maybe this isn't the last one, I'm sorry. The measure of how much of a company's total assets have been financed by debt. Total debt to total assets. You take the total liabilities and divide that by the total assets. So those are both on the balance sheet. Total debt to total assets includes both short-term and long-term debt. If it varies substantially from that original debt-to-equity ratio, the company may be relying heavily on short-term debt. And a heavy reliance on short-term debt can denote more risk. Why? Well, it means, if you think about it this way, it means you could be refinancing your company with credit cards. Because short-term debt is usually more expensive. It, you know, it comes due in much shorter time period. So that can denote more risk. Or it may just be that's the way the industry operates. Right? So we take a look at the total debt to total assets. And what do we get? About 86% in the case of Ford, 85.9%, which is, you know, in my humble opinion, not great. I'd like to keep it less than that personally, but then again, I'm just an individual. I'm not running a car company. So you take a look at the other car companies and then take a look at drug companies and then take a look at the banks and take a look at those companies in that industry and compare those ratios to one another. And that, dear students, is our discussion of financial statements and ratio analysis. And so we have done the heavy lifting. We have introduced ourselves to stocks and go back over Chapter 5, study that material, listen to it, watch it, make flashcards, get that study guide out and make sure you understand every term on that study guide. We've done the calculations in chapters 5 and 6, the ratios in chapter 5, and then the very, very cool dividend discount models and not so cool price ratio models in chapter 6. And then we've learned how to do financial ratio analysis, more of that, in chapter 17. Now it's time for some silliness. I'm a big Monty Python fan and they were into silliness. It's time for something completely different. Because we're going to take a look at chapters 7 and 8, where there's some material there that's important for us to know, but it's not the heavy lifting, right? Make sure you go back over chapters 5, 6, and 17. But now we get to chapter 7, we're going to take a look at stock price behavior and market efficiency, or lack thereof. And then we'll take a look at behavioral finance in chapters 8. And technical analysis, supreme silliness. So be prepared for some silliness, but still some good stuff, as we finish up our last two chapters on stocks, 7 and 8. Be awesome, dear students. As always, we thank you so much for being in our class. We are incredibly privileged, I feel, incredibly privileged to be teaching you this material as you become already, you're already officially investment gurus, and now know more about stocks than most people from what they read on the watch on the television, the talking heads. You are awesome. So go out there and now start doing research on all the different companies and finding which ones attract you, which ones are the ones that you are gravitated towards. And we, of course, wish you the best of luck and success, as we will do over and over again. See you in our next chapter, dear students.